And it is time once again for the Lean Into Artcast, the show where a couple of visual storytellers get together and take a walk around a difficult and challenging topic. We usually start out with a curveball where we throw each other a difficult question that is doesn't have a clear or pat answer. Dive 1,000 feet up to deal with our main topic in an abstract form. But then to make it useful, we go back down to the ground to share some stupid helpy tips and resources based on the discussion that we had that day. And then we close out with the takeaway. What happened to us this week? My name is Jersey Drost. Who's that other guy over there?
Hey, I'm Rob Stenzinger. Ribbit.
is that referring to what you said before we started recording?
It is. I'm in Phineas J. Frog mode.
Don't worry. I could do enough talking for six people, apparently. So we got a guest again. We have another friend of the show coming on, a Lean Into Art instructor, as a matter of fact.
Ooh.
Yay.
That's right. You're a Lean Into Art instructor, Casey.
I sure am.
And you're somebody that I don't get to talk to enough.
I know, right? We got to do something about that.
You actually made it onto last week's show as a recommendation. We recommended
really?
Casey Van Heist, the brand, for people to follow.
Oh, yeah.
In oh, general. Thank you.
As a dynamic internet personality.
Yeah, that's what we said.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. That's a really nice way of saying that I tweet in caps a lot. Which I do.
And yes, but I also mentioned, and I've told you this to your face, Casey, that you're one of the few people who can like pull me out of tweeting hibernation. You know, I'll be watching Twitter for days and days and not interacting, and all of a sudden Casey will say something that'll make me say, well, I gotta chime in on this. So there's just something about you that just draws out engagement. So
I'm going to drop some truth. I do that on purpose sometimes. If I'm feeling really ornery about comics, I'll try to drop some really baiting comments. Sometimes to see if I can get you to respond. Sometimes just to see who else I can draw out. I haven't done that as much recently. I got to get back in on that. But I haven't had any new bees in my bonnet recently. I think everybody just kind of knows my deal. So, going through.
Not even
or
the
do
DC.
We?
Not what?
I said, or do we?
We'll find out today when we get into the main body of our topic. Oh, first, we got curveball. And Rob, I have an email that was sent to us at leanintoart@gmail.com. I thought we could bat this one back and forth. Did you get a chance to look at it?
Yes, indeed.
So do you want me to just go ahead and do a reading of it, and then you guys can chime in on trying to tackle this curveball, try to whack it out of the park?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, sounds
Bring
awesome.
It on.
So we got an email from Natasha J, Psycho Art Tasha on Twitter. And she says, the basic question is, here's the gist, is how do I go on with trying to start a creative storytelling life when I have an arch nemesis whose very existence keeps me subdued? Hang on to that, because here's what she explains. Since I'm 31 and just now putting the effort into doing the whole do what you want with your life thing, after fighting for so long, I decided it was time. So I'm going to school for a visual communications degree, and I want to put some of my stories to web and print. There's just one problem. I was browsing the internet one day in my early 20s, and lo and behold, I find someone who not only does the same subject matter that I do, she has my first name. Not only that, she's a master's in art at two different art colleges while I'm about to get an associate's at a community college. And basically, she does everything that I have ever wanted to do, minus the comic thing. So my brain told me, wow, she won. You lose. You're officially not allowed to draw ever. I feel like I have kryptonite strapped to my chest. So she asks us to weigh in. Let's see. She was wondering if she could get a quick response of what she can do to make herself not throw every sheet of paper
destroy
in the
her.
Trash. What's that?
Destroy her. Eat her essence for power.
What else is a nemesis good for, right?
That's what you do when you meet your doppelganger. You battle them to the death. I mean, I thought, right?
You Indiana Jones 2, punch through their chest and grab that heart, get all that yummy energy.
Yeah. That's right, exactly. When I first read it, I thought she meant that they had the exact same full name. And I was like, wait, I misunderstood. And I thought that she meant that she was worried about having the same name and not being able to. And I was like, I don't think cartooning is like SAG. You don't have to change your name when you join.
You just put a J in the middle, right?
Yeah, there you go. No, I don't know. I mean, unless you're worried about it for Googling purposes, which at that point, I don't think that should be a problem.
Well, I'm curious, Casey. So have you been in a, when have you found a sign that has daunted you, like it from proceeding with comics or has that ever come up?
No, she touched on a really, I feel like a classic case of it where it's always really daunting when you see somebody who does what you do, what you want to do, but better. It's even more daunting when it's somebody who's considerably younger than you. And I feel like that's just something that is, I'm learning now, is only going to get worse as you get older, where you're going to keep meeting that 19-year-old who is better than you are currently, much less where you were when you were 19. But that's always going to happen. And there's always going to be somebody who's jealous of what you're doing. So I feel like it's the kind of thing that it's a hard lesson. It's you have to kind of learn to not compare yourself to other people. But that's one of those things that's easier said than done. Like, I've been there. I'm still there sometimes. But you have to know to step back and to say, no, I'm me. And that's the other Natasha. So I just have to do my own thing. There's going to be something that differentiates you from what she's doing. And as you go, your voice will develop and you naturally become different. But that can be really hard. I mean, I've run into situations where I've read stories that sounded in concept way too similar to the type of story that I wanted to do. And I was like, well, I can't do it now because somebody else did it. But then you have to realize that when you do it, by merit of you doing it, it's going to be something different. So I think.
I would like to attack the premise here just real quick.
Cool.
But let's hate the sin and not the sinner, as they say. Wow, she won, you lose. You're officially not allowed to draw ever. Now, Natasha was probably joking around here, but this is something that I run into a lot, is that, you know what, guys? There's only so much success to go around. It's in a 48-ounce bottle, and it only gets doled out to a few people at the top, and the rest of us, we just got to eat crumbs. You know, success has a lot of different definitions. Success is a rubbery, flexible thing, and since when did we walk into a world where somebody doing something well precludes anybody else from ever doing anything well? If that was the case, then as soon as this generation of stars is done, we are bereft of art.
That's it. We're done.
Exactly. Nothing new under the sun. Oh, well, pack it in. Just wait till we crumble. It reminds me of two different kind of, and I don't mean this with, sorry for the disclaimer, Natasha, but no disrespect. But I think of how we run into misperceptions and fallacies that become hangups and stuff. And there's two that this kind of seems to possibly have within it. I think like Jersey was hitting on the scarcity fallacy, where somehow there just isn't enough to go around. But, well, more people are being born, and there's new people that will have never seen your work that may be a potential market all the time. Just stick around. but then there's the originality fallacy too, where I run into this a lot, where it's the, someone said that already. There's too many, you know, books in this genre. You know what? I bet there's still 1,000 new original zombie ideas every minute.
Mm-hmm.
And yep, there's a lot of those ideas out now. Whereas maybe 8-10 years ago, there wasn't that many, but, or there weren't that many being shared, but I don't know, with that popularity, look at that as an example, actually, for just for a second.
Mm-hmm.
If the originality or the scarcity fallacy were in play and real and insurmountable, would there be so much money to be made by all of these different zombie properties? Right.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't know. It's always really weird when it comes to something that becomes popular like that. There's always room to grow on it. I mean, there's always cycles to go through in popular ideas where I feel like the one that I see the most is you get the genuine version of it turning into the parody until the parody becomes the new norm. And then suddenly it's fresh and new to be earnest about it. And it's the kind of thing that it just keeps going back and forth until you've been doing it for 50 years. And suddenly it's just, I mean, there's always going to be somewhere new, and it's always going to come back around to the something is going to change about, even if you want to do something about zombies. Like maybe you go, oh, I'm tired of how serious The Walking Dead is about it. I'm going to do something funny. But you think about like Shaun of the Dead, that was done too, but it was done in response to movies that were serious. So I think it's the kind of thing, like there's always going to be room to improve on something that's already out there. There's always going to be a new take on it.
And as you hinted, or not even hinted, but just said plain out loud, Casey, is that it will be original by virtue of coming out through your voice, unless mm-hmm. you're blatantly copying and stealing from somebody, which all know we shouldn't do. So
yeah, but even then, there's still going to be something a little different. I mean, unless you are just photocopying pages of something. Like if I photocopied a page of Spider-Man and I was like, I did this, then yeah, of course I'm not bringing anything to it. But even if I was like, oh, here's my character, tarantula dude, like there's still going to be something of me that sneaks in there as hard as I try not to. So even if you are not trying to do something, it's always going to be about you. And there's always going to be somebody out there that appreciates that.
So art exposes us, and it mm-hmm. exposes us. Whoa. Mine just all over the wall behind me. But it does, right? I mean, it exposes who you are to the world, and it exposes you to some of the most scary emotions in the entire world, because it is forcing you to be honest. It's the magic mirror gate from the Neverending Story. If you haven't watched it in a long time, folks, the story still holds up. Special effects, not so much, but I still like it. So, if anybody else has any curveballs that they want to throw at us, or if you have thoughts on this one, if you have some that you want to pitch into the discussion and say, hey, Jersey, you're wrong about this and you should have listened to Casey, or Rob had it right all along and you guys stepped all over him, you can email us at leanintoart@gmail.com. You can also throw a curveball of your own, and we will, if it's a challenging enough curveball, we will address it on the show. So, guys, are you ready to dive into topic?
Always.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Keeping it on task. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and cue the music so we can go 1,000 feet up. Change it up, change it up. Try and do something a little bit more stilted and regimented. We kick into mining the medium of manga. Because Casey, you have said before on the Lean Into Art website, through your class, manga is a medium after all.
Yes, it's basically just comics, but it's also not. But no, it's really, I feel like a lot of people try to say that it's, they treat it like a genre. Like they say, they put it in the same category as like, oh, superhero comics or manga.
Westerns or horror and manga.
Yeah. Yeah. And that just, that's the big bee in my bonnet that I mentioned before. So if anybody's here that's new, welcome to Casey. So
who's always angry.
Always angry, mostly about manga.
So is this something, I mean, I want to poll the room. Is it, because, I mean, you know, I don't talk to that many people. Is this something you still run into on a regular basis, this kind of misconception about manga?
Not to the same extent. Like, I feel like I don't hear the same... actually, yeah, I do. I feel like you get the people that think that all manga is like Naruto. You know, it's cool teenagers fighting each other, or it's like Fruits Basket or something like that. And those are both fantastic series, but people will say, oh, I liked that once. But they're all the same. It's all the same story. And it is very much not. And the comics industry in Japan, the manga industry, is so much bigger and so much more diverse than probably anywhere else. So saying that is doing a disservice to tens of thousands of comics and just countless people both working today and who have worked in the past that are bringing a lot to comics as a medium, that it's really, really unfair to kind of just shove off to the side and say, oh, well, it's all kids stuff.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it reminds me of the argument that was grown-ups leveled at comics 20 years ago, where it's like, oh, yeah, I read comics once, but I kind of grew up. I outgrew them after all, you know?
Yeah.
And you were telling me, Casey, I think, I forget where we were discussing this, but you were telling me that people say that now. People say it about manga. Like, oh, I used to be into mangas, but then I grew up.
Yeah, which always kills me when they're like, oh, I grew up out of, I used to read manga, but I outgrew it, and now I read Calvin and Hobbes or something like that. And you're like, well, I don't think you're really looking at this the right way. Because one, there is plenty of manga that's aimed at an adult audience. And two, just because you're older doesn't mean that you can't enjoy the same thing. Like, you can still read something like Yotsuba, which is perfectly suitable for like 10-year-olds or 8-year-olds or something like that.
So you just said a word. I didn't know what it is, Casey. What was that? The Yotsuba?
Yotsuba. It's a series.
Okay.
It's one of the few books I didn't bring in here, but it's a series. It's very kid friendly. It's about a little girl who's like 4, who just does not know how things work. And Jersey, have you read it?
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. Really good.
Yeah.
It's and so it's charming.
It's the kind of thing. Yeah, it's super charming, but I just feel like it's not fair to I don't know. It just feels really weird to me that there's this weird kind of double standard where it's okay to read American comics or like newspaper strips or things like that that are aimed at children, but to say, oh, I outgrew manga is a whole other thing. But I feel like it's the same. I feel like it's not a self-conscious, oh, I'm sorry, Yotsuba is 5. But no, I feel like it's the same kind of thing that, I went through that phase when I was a kid where you move on to the next thing and then you're really desperate to kind of say that, oh, that thing I was into before, that was for babies, but I'm a grown-up now. So I like grown-up cool things and I don't like the baby things that I used to like. So I feel like it's kind of an extension of that where some people don't necessarily recognize what it is about what it means to look at something with a more mature light. And they feel that it's the genre or it's a particular area of it that was the kid thing when it's really just the approach.
I used to watch Pixar films, but then I outgrew them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like, I mean, Jersey, you're a perfect example of this, like going back and being able to look at Transformers or He-Man.
Actually, when we get to my takeaway, I'm a bad example. We'll find out, but that's a little foreshadowing when we get to takeaways at the end.
Yes. I mean, there are bad ways to do that. But when you can look back on something and say, oh, here are the great thematic elements of this, then I feel like it takes a lot more work to reach that than it does to be able to. It's a lot easier to just say, oh, well, I'm grown up. I'm not going to look at that at all than it is to go back to it with a critical eye. And we had such a big manga movement in the States in teenagers, and now everybody's hitting that age where they're in their mid-20s or so, and they have to be grown-ups. So I feel like that's kind of it. That's my really long, rambly answer. But I feel like that's where I was trying to get this entire time. So
it's interesting. I know this isn't the topic of today, but it reminds me of kind of the flow that metal experienced in the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. Where it had a huge heyday, and then sort of, depending on what you followed, it kind of died in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Kind of, not fully, but
it
more
became a lot less fashionable, right? It's like,
oh my, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
So maybe that's part of a just a generation figuring out their overall voice and their consumer habits and what defines them now. Mm-hmm. And on the angle of the consumer aspect, I'm wondering if there's a huge like distortion factor. Like we can't have a perfectly clear lens on this, because thinking about, well, why would people perceive manga as just a separate thing or overly compartmentalized? Think about how it appears in your day-to-day life as an average, you know, American or what have you. It all of a sudden appears on a shelf, probably in a store, where theoretically it could actually be the store because there's so much to offer.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But you know, but of course, as a business, there's not like they're going to just instantly switch over. So it's always got a section, and they're kind of managing it like that, almost trying to cram it into a genre, because it's more like, looking at, overseas released albums, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where, yeah, they have their section, but because of the expense of trading that good or something, inherently, it could get a cachet because, oh, it is more scarce, right? Mm. So neat. And I'm one of the people who goes to that section. And so it has a little bit of a, I don't know, kind of a, an excitement to it because of that. And I just wonder if that distorts how we look at it.
Yeah. That's a good point. That's something that I hadn't really considered before. I think a lot of it does have to do with how manga was brought into the industry in the States, where you had companies like Tokyopop that were basically fetishizing it. They're saying, this is cool and different. This is exactly this type of comic. They only brought over one specific type of thing. And that's when those subsections that you were talking about came out. And I think now that you mention it, I hadn't really considered it from that angle before, but I think a lot of it was in the presentation. And I think we're only now starting to get to a point where we're not seeing it anymore, because like you're getting more companies that are doing things and then also releasing manga where they have a normal line. I mean, you get some that are doing these beautiful art treatments of books. But then you get like Fantagraphics puts out manga now, Drawn and Quarterly puts out manga. I think, oh my goodness, I cannot remember his name. Chip Kidd is working on a book that he's helping to bring out over here. So there's all kinds of people like that. And it's becoming more of a thing where I think we'll start seeing it being accepted as just another side of comics, in the same sense that most of the time when a popular European comic comes out over here, like Black Zed, somebody like Dark Horse can just grab Black Zed and put it in their regular line instead of saying like, oh, this is the manga line. This is different. It's not like those over there. This is a totally different thing. So I think it was a marketing strategy that worked for a while and failed. And we're kind of seeing the fallout of that. And I really had not thought about it like that before. So,
well, maybe the sustainable way will when we see the genres just merging and, mm-hmm. There was, in watching your class, I was wondering if you could, give us like a quick, the list of, essentially the different sections of manga that I had no idea until saw your class. I mean, because you're like naming these different age ranges and whatnot, mm-hmm. and sort of, you know, the male female stuff where, I thought, oh my gosh, that makes so much make more sense. Cause for me, I actually only knew Shonen and, mm-hmm. Shoujin, and I think that's it.
Yeah, well, up until fairly recently, those were really the only genres that were being published in the States. Shonen is like, it's the one that everybody knows, I think. That's the first one that everybody thinks of. It's the fighting stuff. It's like,
makes me want to toss a Kamehameha wave.
Exactly. Yes. Yep. Yeah. Dragon Ball Z is a perfect example.
Right.
There's, and even in that, the genres or the age ranges are very fluid. You'll get something that is technically in the shonen category. Like I just started watching the new JoJo's Bizarre Adventure TV series, which is a shonen series that started in the mid 80s. And it ran in Shonen Jump up until 2004, I think. And it is incredibly gory and incredibly violent. So it's the kind of thing that you're like, this was in a magazine for 8-year-olds. So it's, there's some really heady topics that kind of come up. There's some really, sometimes some very violent things, sometimes some very just unexpected topics that come up. So you get that all across them. There are titles that I thought were aimed at, like, you think would be aimed at young girls, but they were published in magazines for adult men or something like that, where you don't really expect it that way. Like, one of the examples I have here is, two of them, actually. There are these beautiful series by Kaoru Mori. The first is called Emma, which is about a Victorian maid. And it's just a romance. It's just a really slow, delicate romance story about a maid falling in love with a high-class gentleman. And just kind of this, like, classism in Victorian England. And I was like, oh, okay, this is a women's comic. But it was published in a magazine for men. So it's
Downton Abbey, everybody.
Yeah, basically. Unfortunately, you cannot find this book really because it's part of a deadline. But you can find Bride's Story, which is by the same artist. And it's a similar thing. Like, it also ran in a series for men, and it's about this young woman living in, I think, 19th century Mongolia. I'm probably wrong about that. It's been probably about a year and a half since I read it. But it's just a very slice of life quiet kind of thing. And it's about relationship issues and kind of the typical what you hear a women's comic is. So it doesn't necessarily hold. But getting back to the genres, you have shonen, which is the young male genre, kind of. You have shoujo, which is the young girl genre, where you have things like, and even in that, that kind of varies. You get Sailor Moon, you get Fruits Basket. It goes from the like high school romance, this is my first boyfriend kind of thing, to the dark Victorian dramas. There was one of my favorite series was very bloody. It was it's the Earl Cain series by Viz. Godchild, I think, is the final section of it. And it was about these kind of fairy tale and culture-themed murder mysteries a lot of the times. And it got pretty violent. And it was another thing that ran in a series for like middle grade girls. So it can kind of run through it. And then the adult ones are seinen, which is the adult male, which is really just kind of the, we didn't know where else to put this category, because you get things like the templates that I showed you. You get things like all of Urasawa's work. You get these, you know, these page turning thriller dramas. You get like
Twin Speak is in there. That's the part that confuses me.
Yeah, exactly. It's, that's what I mean by the, like, we don't know what else to do with this kind of thing. So you get that, you get like biographies on JF Kennedy. I think there was a Kennedy one, but yeah, you get like biography comics about officials. You get things about tasting wine.
Drops
you get things about cooking. Yes, which is another fantastic series by Vertical. And then Jose is the one that we're only very, very recently starting to see come out in the States, which is the adult women's stories. And I really, unfortunately, don't have any examples to show you, because it's the kind of thing that we haven't seen until very, very recently. And you get things like, you know, I don't even know. You get stories like Hatarakiman, I think is one of them, by Moyoko Ano. And it's a story about a woman working in the publishing industry. And it's just about her working the publishing industry. It's about her just trying to balance her life with her job and stuff like that. So it runs everywhere, and it's really exciting to me. And that was what drew me to manga in the first place. And that's what keeps me excited about it, is that you can do anything. And it's not just kind of like, you know, anybody can go out there and publish, which is also why I love indie comics, is because there's no, or self-published comics or web comics or things like that. You can do whatever you want, but this is almost more exciting in a way, because it's kind of backed and it's industry-wide. It's not kind of like, you're not fighting the mold by doing something like that. You're just making comics. And so I think that's something that is exciting, and I think it's ignored a lot. So,
it's interesting. I keep thinking about the business angle of it too, and wondering, because that's one of the reasons why the Japanese example of comics, manga, is so robust. It's because, well, it has succeeded as a thriving business with a lot of variety in the customer base too. Right. I mean, and then it's been refined over many decades since, I mean, so how long has been manga been viable in Japan and very healthy?
Since the 30s, I think. That's something that I've only very recently started learning about. At SPX, there was actually a phenomenal workshop or a panel about it that was talking about Tezuka and how his early influences were like Floyd Gottfriedson and Carl Barks. So he got started on Disney Comics, and it's great. I believe there's an article somewhere that's kind of to that extent. I actually forgot to look about for it, but really exciting. What's up, Jersey?
Oh no, I was just chuckling. I'm making a note to follow up with you on that article. On
Yeah. I have to find it. And if I do, I'll make sure to put it out there. But it's really cool, because the manga industry is probably roughly as old as our comics industry. And it's really cool. The more I learn about old manga, like I've really only gotten as far as Tezuka in the 40s or so, something like that. But the more I learn, the more interesting it is. It's kind of like an alternate universe version of the American comics industry, where you see so many different places where it diverged, where before, you know, you kind of wonder how it became a thing where One Piece can sell 8 million copies in Japan, where something here is a success at 10,000, which I'm not knocking at all. That's phenomenal. But it's just, it's such a stark contrast that you start to wonder what the difference is and kind of just how the industry's evolved. And it's the kind of thing that you can compare points in history and you can see where things changed. Like right now, I've been trying to learn more about the Year 24 group, which is a group of women artists that came up in the 70s, like Ryoko Ikeda, who did Rose of Versailles, which is actually the anime is coming out here, but that's a incredibly influential series. You get Moto Hagio, who's actually being published here. Drunken Dreams was nominated for an Eisner, I think. And that was some of her work. She has a new book, or not new, it's very old in Japan. There's a book called Heart of Thomas that's coming out. I think either Fantagraphics or Drawn and Quarterly has it. But it's very interesting watching because those were coming out in the late 60s, early 70s to late 70s, about the same time as we were getting like the Marvel romance comics. And then they went, well, girls aren't reading comics, and they just kind of went away. Where when you had these strong women in comics come up, it created an entire new genre and took it in a crazy new direction. Like they were tackling some really intense themes, and it marked the genre or the demographic even just from then on. And since we didn't have something like that, it's just really fascinating to see that.
Definitely. What was that group of, and we'll capture this in the show notes again, but what was that group of women called? Sure.
They're called the Year 24 group.
The Year 24 group. Okay.
Yep.
That's
and
awesome.
I really can't speak with a lot of authority on them because I'm still learning about them, but we're starting to see a lot more of their stuff coming out here. And that kind of ties in with more Jose coming out, and it's really exciting to watch it come out. I'm trying to think of some more names that are out here. Keiko Takemiya is one of them. Oh goodness, I cannot remember the name of her book. This is terrible. To Terra is one where it was a sci-fi epic, and that's out through Vertical, I think. So, but yeah, it's just watching these kind of parallels in the comics history of what happened on one side and what happened on the other that kind of changed things. And I don't know, that's really exciting to me. So.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, and not to, I do think the art and business are working together there where, you know, you have the people who were drawn into the single section of manga, discovering essentially a gateway to an entire world of options that are far beyond the initial things being offered. And I don't know. I mean, I could easily see that somehow helping spring forth, you know, the integration of the genres and whatnot as those people are getting into positions to do distribution and opening up their own shops and all that.
Well, I'm curious if it's time, now that we have gotten everybody excited about this thing called manga, if you haven't tried it out yet, and Casey blew out of her manga rifle a whole bunch of different great places to start, which we will link to in the show notes.
Yeah, whatever. Sorry, that was a lot of, like, name buckshot there, I think.
No,
I can
no,
try to
great.
Compile
That's great because people,
it's awesome.
People could just go to leanintoart.com and look in the show notes to find out some of the things that you mentioned if they don't remember the name. But I'm wondering if it's time to get down to the ground and talk about defining these different four types of manga and what we can learn as Western artists from studying them. So with that, unless anybody has any objections.
No, sounds good to me.
Okay, well then I'm going to kick in the stinger. Time to hit the ground. And hit it running. Oh, this clip is longer than I thought. I meant to start it earlier, I guess. Okay, so we've got four kinds of manga. We've got shoujo, shonen. What was
Seinen
it?
And Jose.
Seinen and Jose.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I'm curious, Casey, if you can help define what makes these four types of manga different? Like, what is there anything generally that the authors tend to do in these four different types of manga that we can make a broad generalization out of? And what does it have to do with us as Western cartoonists?
I think a lot of what you can see in the difference of it is probably theme, where you get more, like in Shonen, you get more like burning spirit, uplifting themes and things like that, where it's very, it's almost kind of moralistic in a way, in the same way that I think a lot of old superhero comics are. I think it's hard to articulate, but I think it's a difference in kind of the approach thematically and what you're seeing. Like, you're not going to get these dark, bleak, futureless wastelands in Shonen as much as you are in like a Seinen series, where you might get something that has a kind of a more desolate ending, where it feels a lot more hopeless, which is not necessarily the case, but I feel like you're not going to get that in the younger genres. It's usually going to be more triumphant, more high energy, more like we can do it kind of thing. You get that both in Shonen and Shoujo.
Do your best.
Where you don't. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's where that comes from. Yeah. And that's thinking back to the question we had earlier, that was always one of my favorite things. And that's what got me into watching Shonen and Shoujo, is you would get things where the moral of it was just, it was like, believe in yourself. That's kind of a reoccurring theme you see in so many different series, where it's just like, you know, kind of like, believe in yourself.
What is it? Bakuman. You know? Bakuman. It's like, it's continuously in that series, isn't it? Let's do our best.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. It's like that. It's a very common theme to say, you are you. That person is them. You have to go at your own pace. You have to do this yourself as you can, as only you can do it. And that's something that is really good to hear as a kid, I think. Where it's not as much the themes in more like Seinen and Jose. I feel like they're a little more laid back on that, in that regard, where they don't necessarily have to be like terrible and like, the world is horrible, I'm old now, or something like that. But it's generally, they're more subdued, I think, is really what it comes down to. And I think that's the main difference.
There's visual storytelling differences too, though. I mean, like when I think of Fruits Basket and all those close-ups of Toru Honda's face, and, you know, with the patterns behind her and everything, I mean, that feels very different than Dragon Ball. And I'm wondering if you could, like, is that a common thing that you see in a lot of shoujo?
Yeah, and that's something I actually learned fairly recently, I think, is thanks to the Year 24 group. That's when you started getting these borderless panels, the jokes you always hear about the cherry blossoms in the background and the dewy eyes and the sparkles and everything like that, that basically started in the 70s. And it's something, it's still kind of a staple of the genre. It's very impressionistic. It's very much more about capturing the moment than it is about capturing the who, the what, the where. So you'll get these pages that are just these large swaths of, there's no background at all. There's just like a repeating tone, and it's more about the emotion that's involved. It's about evoking a certain feeling. Mm-hmm. And I think that's especially true in the shoujo section of things, where you don't even see that as much in the same age group for shonen, or you don't see that as much, as far as I'm aware at least, in comics for older women. So it's very much something that falls within that. So I think.
That reminds me of something that McLeod talked about, and I think it was Understanding Comics. You know, manga tends to be more about being there than getting there, and that's a broad generalization to be sure. But I think that's one of the things we can look at, right?
Yeah.
Well, and yeah, I'm sorry. I just wanted to tack on to Jersey's point. I'm wondering if there's sort of a really core cultural difference that gets exemplified in American, you know, typical American comics versus typical all the genres in both comic worlds. I'm not talking about just, you know, trying to pigeonhole either, but it does it seem that as a culture, we're more explicit typically. And, you know, like we're more literal about how we express scenes and whatnot versus the different.
Yeah, I think it's very, it can be very fact-based, which I've actually heard people say feels a little cold sometimes, where it's very much about, it's more, I guess, cinematic sometimes. You get in when you think of like the typical Western comic. It tends to be more centered in grids and very specific panel layouts. Whereas the pacing tends to be a little different, when you kind of drop that. And like you were saying, it's more about being in the moment than getting to the destination, where, you don't see as many stories that finish in 24 pages, which is very much, I mean, that's a great thing to be able to do. But you'll get things that take their time and take 3 pages to convey something that happens in 30 seconds. Where, actually I have one of my favorite examples. Like
sometimes, and I know I'm thinking of some of my okay. Some of this, I'm doing a little bit of self-critique. Like I know I at certain points when I was creating, you know, my comic art Geek Zoo on a regular basis, not trying to compare myself to whoever's works, but like I got very bullet pointy, right? And I felt like I was getting the story done, but like but then I read somewhere soon after I closed a major story arc, I read Dororo, is that how you pronounce that? Sorry.
Osamu.
Yeah. And I went, oh, wait a minute. And somewhere after that, in that area, I read Sandland too. And I was like,
yes.
Okay, this is pacing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot of it is about decompression is really one of the big things that you hear about manga is it's all decompressed storytelling. But it's very, it's a very, very strange balance of being decompressed and paced very slowly, but where you still feel like a lot is happening. I actually have an example that I can try to screen share here, I think, of a sequence from A Bride Story where, just gonna pull this up, where we have the sequence where the main character is hunting a rabbit. Mm. And this is something that happens in the span of maybe a couple of minutes where you have these panels where there's literally no background in that one panel. And it goes right to left. So in panel 2 on the first page, you just see a horse and a rabbit. And then the next page is just the shot for shot, kind of aspect to aspect, to use the MacLeod term, of what's happening. And this is all something that's happening in a split second, but it really gives you a sense of being there while this happens. So I think that's something that you don't see as much in America. Well, you start to see it now. And this is the conclusion of the scene where she gets the rabbit. And then you have this kind of quiet moment on the next page. And it really just kind of builds the momentum where, I mean, this is something you could probably just do it in one panel. You could do it in 2 panels. You could do her shooting the rabbit. You could have her picking up the rabbit. But the fact that you can break it down that much really kind of makes this a really kind of intense, just a more intense scene than you would get if it was just very facts-based.
Well, I feel like it's a difference between saying, this is a moment, react to it. So it's like I'm able, by experiencing those panels in that sort of pacing, I'm constructing the emotions, I'm participating more, right? Versus being told, you feel tense. Now you feel victory or whatever, right? Or now you feel kind of, you know, ambiguous, you know, that you've completed this task or whatever, So, you know, in other words, see the rabbit, shoot the rabbit, pick up the rabbit, look kind of remorseful a little bit.
Yeah. It's a very different way. And there's no one that's better than the other, unless there's a specific thing that you're trying to convey. Like if you need to just do it as a quick thing, if that's what the story calls for, then that's fantastic. That's fine. That's not a value judgment to say one is better than the other, but it depends on what you're going for in the story. And sometimes I think slowing it down and really taking that moment and going more minimalistic is something that a lot of creators are kind of afraid to do or don't know how to do properly. So that's something that anybody, even if you don't like manga, which at least give it a chance, everybody, you can learn from it. So I think, especially if you look at somebody who is just beautifully paced, you can learn a lot from a lot of the people.
So. Well, and I'd like to throw in as an addendum to that is I see some comics created nowadays where it's clear that they're working as if it's a storyboard for a film, whether or not they want it to be a film, right? They might just be thinking about it in terms of film, and their storytelling feels like a storyboard to me, which is lovely in its own way. But when I see these manga scenes that are more cinematic, playing with time in unique ways, I feel like in the cases like the example you used and in some of the examples of some of my favorite manga artists like Tezuka, like Matsusuke Yamakami, they're doing it in a way that feels really specific to comics. They're not doing it in a way that feels like it's a storyboard for film. It feels like they're really maximizing comics storytelling ability to create a unique pacing experience, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's not even something that, this is another example, this is just a shoujo called Feromania Syndrome. It never came out here, but it was really cute. But there's a whole lot of nothing going on in the background, but it's a very, very cute, quiet moment.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not even that you can say that there is no... there's no consideration for that, because getting something animated is still very much a big part of doing comics in Japan, but it's just kind of like they don't care. Like you're not shopping it out to somebody. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen, but it's still very much its own medium. And yeah, I mean, I've seen some great comics that do that storyboard format, but it gets a little tiring sometimes to not see the full extent of the comics medium being used, where it's just, I'm sure you've all seen it, where it's the four panels going down on a page and it's just kind of set to TD ratio and
69.
Where there's a lot of beautiful stuff, and I love constraints in comics because there's so much creative output that you can do from it, but that just feels like an unnecessary one to me sometimes. Unless you're doing it for a reason, it just feels like there's a lot more you can do that you're not utilizing. And I think that's something that we can learn from manga. That's a very important thing to kind of take away from it. So well,
I had another point that I wanted to throw at you guys and see how you both react to it. And Rob, especially because you're a fan of the Dragon Balls. Oh, that's not a terrible. I did not mean it that way. I'm sorry. I'm hopped up on cold medicine. I hate it.
I am a fan of the Dragon Balls.
And then I put a lampshade on it. Yeah, that's great. Way to go.
Oh, no. You kind of did.
Yeah, I did. All right. So, but anyway, I was talking with a student recently who's writing a paper on Batman, and she wanted to talk about... the character through the different iterations that he's had in the comics. And she wanted to kind of do some comparing and contrasting with the Kevin Nolan films. 20-something-year-old loves the Kevin Nolan films. Go figure.
You mean Chris Nolan?
What?
Sorry. Chris Nolan.
What did I say? I said Kevin Nolan? Yeah, sorry.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. Really.
No, that's okay.
I'm trying to save you an email.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah, people will. Sorry. Nolan. Whatever, the guy's first name.
Yeah, anyway, yes, I'm sorry.
One of the things we talked about was she was trying to decode why in the comics the Joker has the stretched out, elongated, distorted face, but in the movie, Nolan decided to make him look more, you know, like a guy with like a cut-up face with makeup kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it raised the discussion between the two of us that in comics... everything is rendered in lines, at least if you're drawing in a line style. Therefore, everything is as believable as anything else as long as it's rendered in lines. Whereas in a film with human actors, everything that you introduce in that has to be just as plausible as a human walking around, or it's going to look out of place. So, in other words, comics has this added flexibility in the hyper-elastic reality of line and in the expressiveness of those lines. And so, as a result, when you look at stuff like Tezuka, when you look at stuff like Toriyama, you've got a variety of body types. And you can have Krillin standing next to Piccolo, and we don't say, well, is Krillin, like, you know,
is Krillin a baby?
Yeah, he's really buff. Baby.
Yeah, that baby's really buff. What's going on with that?
So I wonder if you guys could respond to that a little bit and talk about like how manga tends to use this quite a bit.
I feel like that feeds a lot, maybe it is because it's informed by manga, but that feeds a lot into my personal biases. And really any response I can give to this is 100% just my total personal bias of it, where this is what I feel like comics should be. So feel free to ignore me if you do not agree. But I feel like comics aren't real. So you should be able to play with that as much as possible. Like, the Joker's not real, so you should be able to make him as elongated and stretchy-faced and distorted as you possibly can in order to really get across what you need. Where, in a case where subtle character acting really comes through in a film, you're not going to get that by drawing Heath Ledger looking, like, just tracing a screenshot of Heath Ledger looking a little concerned. It's not going to be the same as if you really have to pull it out there. And I feel like that's a place where, and a lot of manga really shines at this. Not all of it. A lot of it is really stiff. But the fact that you can use these expressions to just kind of turn it up to 11 and go really crazy and really, really make sure that what you're trying to say is getting out there, that's absolutely another tool that you should always use. It just, I don't know, that's just a big pet peeve of mine when you get these characters that are very, very clearly just traced to actors, where it's like, I really wish Sam Jackson would play Nick Fury. I wish that would happen, so I'm going to draw it until it does. And that just bugs me so much, because he shouldn't look like a person. He should look like a character, because that's what he is. So.
I think building off that, where it's you have the freedom to have that kind of flexibility, but I think artists choose to, within that freedom, they create their own set of symbols that want to evoke different things. So you've got you look at Krillin's proportions. He's not quite a baby, especially later on in the series, but I in Dragon Ball, baby, right? Just martial arts baby, whatever. But he's totally not, and it's believable in the context of the compared to the rest of what you're seeing, and you're doing that so the artist knows that the audience is going to see all these symbols together and contrasted against one another, and so I think they're using that flexibility with reality to say, you know what, I don't have to have everyone in some relative height range. I can amp it up, I can crank it down, and it is I get to put more information in here by having that contrast. So you get to know, Krillin, he's got a tough road to hoe compared to someone like Piccolo, right? Anyway, it's
and that's a really good visual shorthand for him as a character. Like you said, that's the kind of thing you can see just by looking at him. You can say, oh, he's got it tough. Yeah, he's not really suited for this. And that's the kind of thing that you can absolutely get away with. I think the only thing is you just have to make sure that you keep it internally consistent. That's really the only thing you have to do, is make sure it makes sense within your world. And then you can make whatever decisions you want.
Oh, one example I would kick myself for not bringing up. Have you seen Captain Harlock, Endless Odyssey?
No, I have not. Okay. Speaking of the classics. I should add that to my list of old things that I'm rediscovering.
It is very interesting, the kind of the style contrast among the characters. It's almost as if multiple genres were mashed together to form the overall set of symbols. Mm-hmm. And then your expectations and how they're played with throughout that series. I don't want to ruin anything or whatnot, but you would expect certain things out of the more the distorted, honestly, they look a bit like 19 you know, 1930s Popeye kind of characters that happened to be. What you would expect, and the situations that are that they're in are act can be intense and really dramatic. They play with that quite a bit.
And I think that's something, that's another thing that can really be learned, not just from manga, but from older manga especially, and I'm seeing this more. It takes a lot to get used to it first when you move into Tezuka, or like Shigeru Mizuki is the big example I was just thinking of that just reminded me of going cartoony in really intense situations. He is actually a survivor of World War II. He was a soldier, and he did a semi-autobiography that was about him basically being told to go on a suicide march. And the entire story is done super, super cartoony. His style is absolutely ridiculous, but it's the one of the most heavy, just gut-wrenching things I've read.
Wow.
And it's another thing that was done as a, it's very internally consistent. Or it's done with conviction. It feels very jarring at first because the backgrounds are photorealistic. Like the way that he draws the jungles of the South Pacific are incredibly detailed. He does like these photorealistic, beautiful crosshatched palm trees. And then you have this goofy cartoon character standing next to it. And as long as you sell that with enough conviction and you make sure that you keep doing it, then it's absolutely going to create a world where you can get completely lost in it.
Actually, Calvin and Hobbes this. And we all agree that Calvin and Hobbes is one of the finest comics ever made. But look at the Spaceman Spiff stories, where he's this really cute, super cartoony little guy in this rich alien landscape, or when he's fighting dinosaurs and the dinosaurs are rendered in a semi-realistic style. Calvin's in the cartoony style.
Yeah.
Watterson was doing this stuff, man. Bill Watterson. Oh, yeah, I know his first name. It's not Chris Watterson.
I love that George Watterson.
Yeah, I like that there, George Watterson. He's good. He's a good drawer.
Yeah. That Jim Kirby. He's my favorite.
Well, you know, are there any other things, like closing this out before we get into takeaways for the week, anything that you guys would put a bow on this whole idea of, like, what are some other things we can learn from manga? Like, what's a great thing to look for while people go to their local independent bookstore to pick up a manga and try one out, or their local library?
Do you mean, like, recommendations for books? Or?
No, like another thing to look for that manga does so well that is not done enough in the United States or North America.
That's a tough one.
Can I put a twist on that, Jersey?
Yes, please.
Or it could be something that you've added to your arsenal, Casey, as the indispensable thing, or it could be a couple that are built from that.
I mean, I feel like I've mentioned the two big ones that I grab, which is the page layouts. I tend to try to do, not all the time, but do some non-standard page layouts. And then absolutely pacing. Just anytime, I have a go-to artist that I pick up anytime I need something to be paced tense, like just to have a really tense moment. And anytime I need to do something like that, I just look at what Naoki Urasawa does, because he is the master of that. And I actually know a couple of other people. So that's my go-to, is if you want to do something that's a page-turning thriller, look up his work and learn, just study it. I don't care if you don't like the stories, just study what he does. And I can find, he did Pluto, which is, it's actually an adaptation of a Tezuka work. It's an Astro Boy story that he took from being a 32 page story into an 8 volume epic.
And boy, is it different.
You've read Pluto.
I've read the original and I've read most of the Urasawa stuff, and oh my gosh, it couldn't be more different.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But that's actually a really good example. That, if I were going to give homework, it would be to read both Pluto and read the by Naoki Urasawa, and to find Tezuka's Astro Boy story, The Greatest Robot on Earth, which is what it's based on. And just to see the storytelling, pacing, and just the difference in decisions is stunning, because the same things happen in the story. It's the same exact, if you read a plot synopsis, it's the exact same story. But it's done so differently that you cannot, unless you kind of approach it critically, you can't really tell. It's the same thing. It's just a guy wants to have the strongest robot in the world, so he builds it, and it starts destroying the other robots.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, one of them approaches it as a kid's adventure story, and one of them approaches it as a murder mystery.
Yeah. Mm.
And,
interesting.
And what's the name of the piano-playing robot? Is it White Number 2? Is that his name? What's his
name? North Number 2, I think.
North Number 2.
Yeah.
Kurosawa's handling of North Number 2's fate is so emotionally rough. It's so difficult to get through. And when you read the original Tezuka one, which was a story for little boys, it's just like, I will fight you. No, you won't. Yes, I will. Blam, blam, blam. Boom. Blow up. But then Urasawa takes
it. Yeah, there's like screws and sprockets flying.
Yep.
And I'd read the Urasawa story first, and I was like, why would you do that to him? It's just crazy.
It's really good.
So, so cool to say.
Yeah, it's a masterwork. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
Super
so
cool.
So that's your homework, everybody.
Sounds like we got a lot of good homework. I just want to make a quick shout out. We've got Ryan Estrada in the chat, and wouldn't be a Lean Into Art Cast without a shout out to Ryan.
Don't say it three times though. He'll appear next to you as an Obi-Wan Kenobi
exactly.
ghost.
he shares a something he learned. He goes, I learned a lot this week from looking at the more, you know, cheapy, not famous manga that gets turned out, just to see all the tricks they use to draw fast while making striking, exciting pages. So that's essentially looking for rapid production techniques. That gets me curious too.
I 100% agree with that. Don't just look for the greatest hits. Find some of the mid-list titles. Find some of the stuff that's not good enough to get translated, and just look at it. Don't read it. Just look at it. I feel like there was a great story of. I feel like it was in the 90s at Marvel. There were editors who would get copies of Spriggan or things like that and just give them to the artist and say, do this. I don't care. You don't have to read it. Just do something like this. This is how you tell a dynamic story. Mm. And so sometimes it's worth it to just be able to look at it and read it untranslated and see how much of the story you can get without actually being able to read the dialogue. Because a lot of the times you can pick up pretty clearly what's happening.
Very cool.
Yep, I've got Dragon Balls. I got Dragon Ball comics in Japanese. And I can't read Japanese, but you know, it's worth it. I use this to study fight sequencing and the pacing of dynamic. Here's Krillin going to town. Right?
Yeah, nice. Exactly.
That's right.
So
that baby can fight.
A punching baby.
Stuff like this, where like here's like a panel where it's just the word and then a burst to show how that moment feels. Uh-huh. Right? Look at that.
Yeah.
Dragon Baller, buddy.
Yeah, it's just explosion. Nice. Yes. Yeah, Toriyama is great at what he does, and I feel really bad that I have not looked at his stuff more, and that's something that. You constantly learn. Like, I feel like I have to give him another shot. No, that's a good takeaway, I think, to just look at it and see what you can get. Even if you don't like it, just see what you can take into your own work. Steal it.
Okay. Well, on that note, we will kick over to takeaways. What did we learn this week? What happened to us this week? What did we take away and we're a better person or a different person after it happened to us? What happened to you guys this week? Close this one out.
Well, I've got one quick. I got pretty far with the latest release of Guitar Fretter. And I was putting in...
Guitar Fretter is an iOS, and is it for Android too?
Indeed, yeah.
It's a game you made. It's a game you designed where you learn how to play guitar by playing guitar. This is a recurring theme, everybody, with Rob Stenzinger, is he likes to make games that teach you how to make games.
Yeah, a little bit of that. I have some recursive brain issue, I think. but I was really, so I for a few weeks now, I've been really close to having this finished, and I've been having to, you know, just... sort of just, I almost like look back at my old playbook as far as like things I've hard lessons I've learned with making software and finishing games and doing it in a way that like, it's like not publishing it before it's ready. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. really listening to Kenny Rogers, you had to know when to hold him kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I actually listen to that anymore. quite a bit as a child, but and yet having doubt where I was like, oh, no, I got to put this aside. I got to a good milestone. I'm just going to check in my source code and, you know, come back to it. And I did that to methodically check these last few bugs off my list. And then I'm doing it one more time too, where I finished the last bug on the list. Like, was it last night? But it was super late, and I was so elated where this could be the moment where I'm like, that's it, publish it, time to rock, it's done. But I know with, you know, this other part of me is like, don't do it, don't do it yet. Wait, test it one more time. And it's cool. I'm glad that that side of me has won those arguments still, because,
yeah, it's hard to kind of stave off that need for instant gratification. You're like, I want to put this out there now. I want everybody to see how cool it is. And that's one of those things that it just, it comes down to discipline, I think, which I guess kind of ties in with mine.
Cool.
Which is like, just a matter of discipline. And it's, I feel like there are a lot of lessons that you have to just keep relearning. And for me, it's been a lesson of focus and discipline recently, where I've been having a really, really hard time just sitting down and getting things done. And it's become like, it's very easy to just get up and get distracted and say like, oh, I can do that later. Or, oh, I have something else I need to work on. And it's one of those things that it's hard to even have an answer for when it comes down to flow. I mean, I recently started co-working on a second comic, and it's really just a matter of prioritizing to work on two things. And I think that's just kind of the process of, even though I'm not the only person that's doing it, or really like probably like 40% of the work is done by me as opposed to like all the heavy lifting, it's still a matter of learning to kind of creatively balance yourself and learn to prioritize. And that's just kind of one of those things that I feel like sometimes you just have to shut up and do it. So it's
but do you find, Casey, that this is something you come back and forth to over and over and over again?
Oh yeah. No, I ADD out like crazy on stuff like that. I get super distracted. I'll be like, oh, I should research what I'm gonna do for this page, and then I just end up rereading a book or something. It's a matter of,
but hold on, how many pages of wintersandlavelle.com are there?
338, I think.
I rest my case, Your Honor. So, I mean, this goes to show that even, you know, you've been in this for the long haul. This isn't something where you're like, oh, I got page 4 up, maybe, you know, I might have to change it. Yeah. Redraw pages 1 through 3.
Yeah, I got the thumbnails for page 2 done, sort of. Yeah.
That's a good point too, is taking a longer view. You know, it can help as far as, you know, if you're into doing the self-critique, I think it's a pretty fine line to where you go from self-critique to, I can be kind of harsh about how I self-critique sometimes, honestly, right? Oh, yeah. And if I'm looking at too short term, especially, and if I do step back and all of a sudden like that, I mean, yeah, my God, Casey, that's awesome. You got so many pages. That's super cool.
I mean, maybe it's an issue of marathon running where you get tired halfway through and you have to wait for that second wind to hit or something like that. I mean, it might just be, it's always hard to tell when you get in a large project. You can't tell if it's a slump or if it's a thing that if you need to just write it out or if you need to reevaluate what you're doing. So that can always be really tough to approach. And I feel like it's frustrating because it's not one of those things that you don't know it until you're on the other side of it. Like when you're in the middle of it, you can't really kind of approach it logically, I think. So that would be my problem. So.
Well, I think it's worth reminding people that it never goes away.
You know? Oh, yeah.
Yep.
So, that's true. You'll always be frustrated.
Exactly.
Comics.
Welcome to hell. Yeah. But that's the life we chose, right? We get to complain about it, but we go in. Oh, yeah. Just go in with your eyes open, kids, and remind yourself when the despair kicks in that this too shall pass. I don't know if I want to go into my takeaway. My takeaway is more of like a story of how I humiliated myself publicly. And
oh, you go on.
Yeah.
Well, now you've teased it. Why not get the bonus humiliation for the price of one?
Well, if anybody hasn't guessed by now, I'm not feeling very well today. I've got the onset of something that feels like the flu. And so I wasn't at my best, but I was in a public place and somebody brought up the topic of the television show Robot Chicken, which, you know, I'm familiar with. A friend of mine works on that show. And they were citing some skit on there that they really enjoyed, which I didn't like so much because it messed with one of my sacred cows, which happens to be He-Man. And I didn't want to go into it. I didn't want to go into it with these guys. And oh, by the way, takeaway headline is know what battles to pick and know who you're fighting when you pick a battle. Because, you know, energy is priceless and you don't want to waste your time. And you don't want to make an idiot out of yourself. But anyway, so I just went into a little bit of the thing like, well, you know, I think there's some things that really shouldn't be monkeyed with. And He-Man blowing off a big fat fart isn't very funny to me, you know, because He-Man, he never meant no harm to nobody. He's a good thing for kids. And so my conversant to the person I was talking with was intrigued by this. They're like, well, tell me more. Like, why do you feel so passionate about this? Well, an onlooker, somebody who wasn't involved in the conversation gets involved. And she says to me... She turns to me and she says, well, you know, those things were just a bunch of crass commercialism, just schlocky stuff, just cranked out to get children to buy things. And she's saying this with this crowning, you know, she's circling around as if I've never heard this before, but we don't know each other.
Oh, no, she took her glove off and slapped you in the face.
And I did turn and give her a Sam Jackson kind of excuse me. I want to make it clear to everybody that I do not find this to be my finest hour. This is one of my lesser hours.
I'm sorry for laughing.
No, that's why I'm telling the story. So okay. I do this, excuse me, and then I go into my treatise. Like, it's like she just tempted me. She dared me. I dare you to go into that long-winded thing that you do about He-Man. And so I went into it, and my original conversant was genuinely interested in what I was saying, or at least appeared to be. And then the woman who jumped into the conversation said, yeah, that sounds all smart and everything, but I'm not going to take anything seriously from a guy with green shoes who has a weird fetish thing about toys. And that was
what?
It. Yeah. Now, okay.
What's this from a stranger?
It reminds me of like a heckler. She was a heckler.
She was trolling me. She was trolling me. And I fed the freaking troll like an idiot. Because then I turned and here's where when I back up, I go, now, if He-Man, you know, if I'm really living by the standards of He-Man like I think I am, I would walk away from this because He-Man doesn't need me to fight this fight for him. This lady's intentionally trying to push my buttons. But I wound up yelling at a complete stranger about a freaking toy line from 1983. What kind of nerd? What kind of freak am I?
She stuck to your shoes. You gotta defend yourself.
Where did the shoes come into it? But anyway, but the point is, what do my shoes got to do with anything? But
I don't know.
But anyway, my
it's
point
not
is,
okay.
Whatever. At least I don't have green shoes. Like, was that just? That's just reaching at that point.
But this story is not to vilify her. The story is to point out my feelings because what I neglected to realize at the moment was that what was I trying to gain? I was doing, and I wonder if I was kind of caught up in some of the stuff that's been going on with politics for the last couple of weeks. You know, people all trying to turn somebody else's opinion around. I don't know.
Yeah.
But what could I possibly have gained from that interaction? What's the win, right? I get this woman to watch He-Man? That's not going to happen. Me yelling at a complete stranger in public in front of somebody who seemed to be genuinely interested in what I was saying turn that person off, right?
It's tough. I mean, everyone's got a line, though, right? I mean, it's yeah.
But He-Man.
I think it's worth it.
You know, I take my hat off to you, man. You stuck to your principles, you know.
No, I'm pretty sure if you think about it enough, we've all done something like that. Like, I'm remembering the time I snapped at a kid in Barnes and Noble because he was like, why would you read these comics here? Because you can get them online for free. And I straight up snapped at a 14-year-old. And I was like, I mean...
But even that speaks to a broader principle than just making fun of something that actually was a commercial for children. The woman had a point. You know, it's just that I didn't like her making that point. That's what I'm driving at.
I'm pretty sure I can find worse, but I will get back to you on that. I'm pretty sure everybody's done something like that. And yeah, the best thing you can do is just say like, all right, well, that lady was a jerk and I'm not going to change her mind and I need to move on. Yep. I think it just feels different because usually that happens on the internet, not in person. And I think that's the only reason that stands out. Yeah. It's like, I think we see that every day on the internet. So
as somebody who frequents the Tumblrs, I'm sure you see this on, you know, an hourly basis, right, Casey?
I tried to cut it out of my tumbling because it got to the point where it's almost like Zen training at that point. If you see it so much and you have to teach yourself not to react to it, like, I think at this point I could just be like, no, I'm done. Somebody could come up to me and just be like, that's for man babies and you're a giant lady child. And I just go, someone told me that I'm better than this. Bye.
That's what Casey does when I leave.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right.
Walk away.
Yeah.
So you basically try yourself in the land of hecklers, essentially. It's like a whole...
it's weight training, you know? You got to put on 100 times Earth gravity. Did I get right?
Totally, yeah. You're Goku on the way to Planet Namek.
He's training, there you go.
100 times Earth gravity, doing 10,000 push-ups. Darn right.
That's what Tumblr is.
Well, here's where I want to try to wrap this around to something useful for anybody else outside of laughing at what silly people we are. You know, going outside, I'm asking for it. There's crazies out there, and I'm going to run into a crazy at some point. The law of averages says that a crazy is going to get in my face and go blah, 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 and then I have to figure out how to negotiate that situation, right? Mm-hmm. So too is it when you share anything online. And the first time it happens, the first time somebody, you know, trolls you, it tends to hurt. It hurts like, oh man, am I really that bad? Oh no, I never did anything to hurt anybody, you know? But the thing I try to remind myself, and this is what I was thinking about as I drove home after that interaction with that strange woman, is, you know, this comes with the gig. It comes with going outside. It comes with putting things on the internet. And if you don't want to encounter that, then, you know, get your Unabomber style shack in the woods and, you know, hole yourself up in there for a while.
Yeah. Just do like Henry Darger and just write in a journal that they'll find after you die. And then you've got this giant thing of books and then you don't have to worry about people telling you that you're ridiculous. No, I mean, I guess the takeaway here, and it's another one of those things that's easier said than done a lot of times, and it feels real kind of like hand wavy to say it, but you can't control them, but you can control your reaction to it. So that's it. That's what we do.
There we go. And that's what He-Man would say.
Yes.
Unless you're targeting that posthumous creative success model.
then go and, for it. I mean,
exactly. Then it's just,
follow your dreams.
Exactly.
Dream on, kid.
Yep.
All right. Well, then guess what? This is where we come up on the end of the show, and I'm going to say, Casey, holy cow, you came in here with a Santa Claus sack of awesome stuff and just spilled it all over the floor and said, dig in, kids.
I hope I didn't drop too much truth on you.
I'm Casey Van Heisen, and I approve of this message.
Exactly. We are rated for many bajillion pounds of truth on this show, so we can sustain it.
So we should say... that, you know what, there's this thing. If anybody who enjoyed the show, if you think like, hey, that's awesome that Rob and Jersey put the show together every week. I wish there was some way I could thank them. Well, there's a free way you can do it by giving us a star review on iTunes or giving a thumbs up to this video on YouTube. But if you want to chip a little bit of our way, you know, like donate to the show, as it were, you can actually help us and help Casey at the same time by checking out Her manga is a medium, not a genre class, which is on sale on the leanintoart.com Season of Creative Challenges page.
That's right.
leanintoart.com/workshops. You can check it out there. I participated in this class. It is a super, super fun class. There are exercises where you can explore Western-style storytelling followed by manga-style storytelling, so you can get under the hood of this stuff. Rather than just going out and doing homework by reading, you can participate, and the downloads are free. There's no DRM. Download link never expires, and it's only $10, and then Casey gets the proceeds from that. So yeah, a way to thank her for her appearance in the show.
Definitely. And if you're listening live and you're about to do that, give me a good 20-minute lead here, because I need to go actually get Casey's class added to the sale.
Rob, I apologize for not checking with you first. Oh, I'm a terrible human being. Here's my takeaway for next week, everybody. Don't pull the trigger on something until you check with your business partner on it.
Oh, no.
No, yeah, you know.
Hey. Well, while you're stalling, you can also support me by reading my comics.
That's right.
You can
check out Casey's book, like Winters in Lavelle, at wintersinlavelle.com. Bye.
ParasiteNights.com.
What was the other one?
Parasite Nights, which I just realized does not work well when you say it out loud. Like, it's, except there's a C in Parasite and it's Knights, like a knight in armor.
The rural juror.
Yeah.
But wintersinlavelle.com. And if anybody's wondering about that voice, that's just the game Casey and I were playing when we were at SPX this year. Is that that's the Winters in Lavelle voice.
That's the voice. Yeah, that's the voice of Winters in Lavelle. So when Winters in Lavelle gets turned into a movie, the voice of the character Winters in Lavelle will be done by Jersey.
When you do the Lord of the Rings intro with like the
Once
history.
Once
upon a time, there was a place called Lavelle.
Sometimes it was winter.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Sold.
No, but it's actually, it remains one of my favorite comics on the internet, wintersinlavelle.com. It's beautifully done. So, seriously.
Awesome.
So, anything else? Oh, Space Case on the Twitters. Space K-S-E-K-A-S-E. And one of the funniest people on Twitter.
Yeah. And of course, all of this, we link to Winters in the Lavelle and Casey Van Heist on Twitter, will be in the show notes as well.
Thanks.
Yep.
So, okay. Well, then I don't think there's anything left to say except thank you once again, Casey, for taking time to be a part of the show. That was super, super fun.
Oh, man. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Super cool. Yeah. Thank you for being
good
here.
Times. It was good awesome. Time.
And everybody go follow her on Twitter now, Space Case with a K. And until next time, everybody, we'll be back probably Tuesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern time. Sorry, we got a little preempted by this big deal happening in the United States. I guess we had to elect a new leader, and we got the old one. What are you going to do? So here we are again, 4 more years. And So we moved to the Thursday this week, but we'll probably be back Tuesday of next week at 9 p.m. Eastern time on the Google Plus and in the YouTubes. Links will be in the show notes at leanintoart.com. Until then, everybody, I have been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user LeanIntoArt, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.